Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. We're going to begin by talking with my friend Doug Heck of EWTN. It's no surprise to everyone, we've tried to cover this bit of news a little bit already, and this has to do with Susan Osterman. She's an abortion rights advocate. She's been very vocal about her position. She's actually called out the fact that she believes any anti-abortion narratives is nothing other than the result of white supremacy, which is rather hilarious considering the fact that she herself is white. But the more important thing is that as a professor at Notre Dame, she was considered to be the leader of the Asian Studies Department, and that incurred significant uproar globally. Many of us wrote in and made our voices heard. And while the university did not recant the offer of her leadership, she decided to rescind it. She decided to pull away from consideration for leadership. She still works at Notre Dame, and so Doug and I talk about this. We talk about why Catholic institutions often kowtow to the need to present ourselves to be more secular. EWTN, Ave Maria Radio, and a host of other Catholic apostolates and institutions have actually shown and strived to show that it is possible to be not only fully orthodox, but to be respectably so. And that simply means being excellent at what we do and being intelligent and diligent about how we do it so that we can engage the culture, sometimes utilizing their own language, without also showing them that we are like them. And that, my friends, is the way forward. Christ really is the answer. His church really has the answer. So Doug will walk us through that. He'll share his wisdom with us. We go on from there to speak with Alberto Fernandez to talk about updates from Iran. What do we know? What can we reasonably say? And whether there are some pathways forward in terms of peace and rebuilding, whether peace can really reign quickly. And then finally, we speak with Joseph Stewart. The cultural historian Christopher Dawson has been called one of the foremost Catholic thinkers of modern times. He retired from Harvard in 62. John the 23rd sent him an apostolic blessing. He contributed a tremendous amount to Catholic thought and its development in history. We talk about all of this after the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Monday, February 3rd. It's the Feast of St. Chad of Mercia. Today's news is brought to you by Visiting Angels, providing loving care and assistance for seniors in need. VisitingAngels.com. Pope Leo says he's deeply concerned over the escalating spiral of violence in the Middle East. Speaking to a crowd in St. Peter's Square Sunday, the Pope made what he called a heartfelt appeal to the parties involved to assume moral responsibility to stop the conflict before it becomes an irreparable abyss. President Trump says the U.S. is ahead of schedule as it conducts Operation Epic Fury against Iran.
Today, the United States military continues to carry out large-scale combat operations in Iran to eliminate the grave threats posed to America by this terrible terrorist regime.
Boots on the ground in Iran as a part of Operation Epic Fury isn't being ruled out by President Trump, telling the New York Post that U.S. troops in Iran are probably not needed, but would send them if necessary. Police in Austin, Texas say they're examining motives that might be connected with the Iran military operation following a mass shooting early Sunday. Austin Police Chief Lisa Davis was asked about images showing the suspect wearing a hoodie with the words "Property of Allah" and an Iranian flag on his undershirt.
We see the second shirt with the Iran and the picture of the Shah on that t-shirt as well. We're thinking about events and what's occurring in the country as well.
Two victims were killed when the gunman opened fire outside a bar. The suspect, a Senegalese native and naturalized U.S. citizen, was killed by officers following the rampage. The Supreme Court will hear arguments challenging a law that bars illegal drug users from having firearms. Lower courts have been divided over whether the restriction violates the Second Amendment. From your Ave Maria Radio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Joining me as he does every week is my dear friend Doug Keck of EWTN. Doug has been involved in the work of evangelization and for a long time now, and he's not only contributed a lot, he's also seen a lot. And he and I are going to be talking about the reality of the Notre Dame professor who was being considered as dean for head of the School of Asian Studies. Doug, thank you very much for joining us. How are you?
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I know both of us are disappointed, but at the same time, I think I speak for you when I say we're not really surprised, and that's
bad. I was going to say, disappointment maybe, but not surprise, correct.
Oh, and I was just lamenting to you just before this interview, how many times do we have to go through stories like this before Catholic institutions learn?
Yeah, well, I've always felt like the problem that I've experienced, and I'll take it from a non-academic perspective, a media perspective, is that, and I think it's applicable, which is I always found, maybe not so much today, but certainly in the early days when I was getting involved with Catholic media and having worked in the secular world for 20 years, I always found this kind of wannabeism that they want to prove that we're just as good as you. We really are news people, and we're really, you know, we're not just Catholic, propagandists here, and so we want to make sure that you respect us, and this kind of, can we go to the party too? And I think sometimes from the land of lakes on, you've got this idea that somehow for a Catholic institution to be seen as a really great form of higher education, you can't allow all of this kind of Catholic accretions and, you know, these things. I mean, you know, they're okay and they have their place. But, you know, there's things that are, you know, that we have to deal with that are beyond a Catholic ethos. And I kind of saw that in my experience of watching that being projected onto the universities in probably even a bigger way than I saw it in the news media. But I thought it was somewhat relatable.
And I'm really glad you gave us that perspective, because I think all of us within the Catholic professional sphere can struggle with that, to be seen and taken seriously by the rest of the secular world. And I invite you to speak to that, how EWTN and Ave Maria Radio, we've navigated that and striving to keep our Catholic ethos in the process.
Well, I think what we've shown is you can be highly professional and still be very orthodox. And I think you have to realize that at the end of the day, if you're really speaking the truth, you're going to be bothering people and annoying people, especially people who have chosen a more secularist approach to the world. And certainly, as we've seen over the last few years, even in the media world especially, you're dealing with people, you know, maybe 50, 60 years ago were kind of middle class men and women looking to, cover a local story. Today, you basically have people who are basically coming out of elite universities who are wannabe the second coming of all the president's men and are there to change the world. And their job isn't to report the news. It's to interpret the news for you people who are too stupid to understand the news in a way that they can explain to you the way things should really be and really understood. And maybe if you'll catch on, the world will be a better place. And that's why their numbers are collapsing, because it doesn't work and their perspectives are quite askew and honestly don't bear up to a scientific method over a period of time. They fall apart.
And we've seen that happen time and time again institutionally, for Catholic institutions especially, to deviate from orthodoxy and the wisdom of the church to try to placate to what the spirit of the times wants tends to not only not benefit the world, it doesn't benefit the institution either.
Right, absolutely. I mean, what is Notre Dame's claim to fame? I mean, its claim to fame is that it's a wonderful a place of higher learning, but also it's a Catholic place as well, where Catholics can feel good about the fact that, first of all, it was the Church who really began the whole higher education process. Even you go to Harvard and Yale, those came out of the Christian denominations in the early parts of the founding of our country, and they fell away. And we've seen that falling away. And we don't want to see that in every Catholic institution. And there's ones that are out there that are good or fighting for that, whether it's Catholic University or obviously Franciscan University has always been, dynamically Catholic, those kinds of situations. But really, Notre Dame was the one that you could look to and say, okay, that's basically a Catholic university. And I'm assuming it still is. But there are these situations where you get people deciding to name people. I mean, the thing with Osterman, who was the one who was the appointment was involved in working there, is basically it's not just a question of, oh, gee, it turns out to be that a cocktail party one day she mentioned, I'm really not that pro-life. She's been very much out there. I mean, I believe she actually was on the board or consulting for a population council, talked about abortion basically a function of white supremacy, and co-authored 11 articles for newspapers and was arguing for legal abortion and against the attempts to ban it. So you're not just talking about somebody who passively is saying, well, that's not my milieu. I don't deal with those things. I'm dealing with foreign affairs, and so it shouldn't really matter. But this is somebody who's coming out publicly. And the trouble with these things happen is the first thing you get is the story in the New York Times talking about how the department head at Notre Dame says that abortion is really white supremacy. Even at Notre Dame, they understand what the truth is. And that's where you get into this whole idea of, I'm sorry, you're giving scandal. Mm-hmm. You want to hold those beliefs, either don't talk about them or go someplace else where they'll be lauded. But we don't need to give scandal to the church. And the other thing that I think bothers a lot of people, I will say for myself personally, having my wife be a big pro-lifer and other people I know who, the Pintos who put their life on the line for the pro-life cause, people who've been arrested in jail, when it gets to certain cocktail party circuits, well, those things aren't that big of a deal. And, we can make some accommodations. And it's like, well, wait a second, we're the people on the front line. We're the people standing up for life. Is it true or not true? Is this not another Holocaust or not? If it's not, why do you keep acting like it is and putting the pressure on us to do the right thing when push comes to shove, you get shoved?
And that shoving needs to happen with firmness. I think we do a lot of good in the charity department, mm-hmm. but firmness, showing that we're not doing this because we're bigots. We're doing this because this is the perennial truth, and we're servants of the revelation of Christ and his church.
Well, exactly. We're not talking about the fact that this particular person might be, overly concerned about the climate and feel that, we need more green energy and maybe we shouldn't have any fuel from the ground and everything should be solar or whatever. We're talking about somebody who is a full-throated supporter of aborting children, killing babies in the womb. And we know what that leads to. It leads to infanticide, and then it also lends itself to the other end of the equation, which is euthanasia. And if Notre Dame can't find somebody who's Catholic to teach this course without destroying their reputation, it's ridiculous. It's the same thing in the church and other things where you say to yourself, are you trying to tell me you can't find a faithful Catholic to fill that role?
Yeah. See, that's what that actually, I'm glad you brought that up, Doug, because that bothers me too. I know innumerable professor friends who've gotten PhDs, and they have to identify as independent scholars because there are not enough positions to go around sometimes. Mm-hmm. And they would do wonders in that position, bringing souls deeper into the love of Christ and his church.
Right, but the problem you end up with that is that they also cause problems. They cause friction. And I've come to see, and I, obviously not being an academic, I tend to take the biased position that somebody once said, those who can't do, teach. And another one said, those who can't teach, teach Jim. And those who can't teach Jim taught at my school. That was a joke from a movie. But that kind of idea of And this idea of this ivory tower they live in of thoughts and concepts. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, they're the most biased people you know.
Right. Well, Doug, tremendous joy. Thank you very much for making the time to talk about this important issue.
Thank you.
My guest has been Doug Keck of EWTN. We've been talking about the problem of the Notre Dame professor who has recently rescinded her bid to be head of the Department of Asian Studies. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Pope Francis said, "The key that opens the door to faith is prayer." Join St. Paul Street Evangelization by running a prayer station in the public square. You don't need to be a professional apologist or theologian. Just listen to the needs of the people you encounter. Offer encouragement, take prayer requests, and pray with people. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Steve and Janet Ray here, announcing we are back in the Holy Land, ready to introduce you to our favorite places in the world, the land where God walked. Mass at the most holy sites, pray the mysteries of the rosary where they happened, and experience the Bible in vivid color. We have led over 100 groups through this land, sharing the whole story of salvation. Of all the pilgrimages in all of the world, this is the one you should not miss.
Find the Ave Maria Radio travel tab at avemariaradio.net.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you automatically own shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Undoubtedly, what's going on in Iran right now warrants a tremendous amount of conversation. We all want to know not only what's happening, but how to think rightly about it. Joining me to have a conversation about this is Ambassador Alberto Fernandez. He has been on this program before. He is Vice President of the Middle East Media Research Institute and a contributor to EWTN News and National Catholic Register. He served as the U.S. State Department's coordinator for Center for Strategic Counterterrorism Communications from 2012 to 2015. He retired in May of 2015. Alberto, thank you very much for making the time once again. How are you?
Thank you. Happy to be on with you.
So the world knows about the initial bombing. We know about the retaliatory bombings. But just give us an overarching view of what things are like in Iran.
Well, I think it's unprecedented what's going on right now. You know, this is a regime that is born in turmoil, born in war. It faced, it fought an eight-year war with its neighbor Iraq in the 1980s. But of course, it's facing a conflict, much of it of its own making, which is unprecedented in the history of most living Iranians.
Now, the fact that it is unprecedented itself is alarming because it's not like Iran has had a completely peaceable political and social existence, especially in the last few decades. Since 1979, we've had upheaval after upheaval and bloodshed. So tell us about that, the fact that this is unprecedented in light of that history.
Well, that's absolutely true. It's since 1979, the Islamic Revolution that brought the current regime to power, a brutal regime, a bloody regime has killed thousands, tens of thousands of Iranians over the last 47 years, and waged war against its own people in many ways, torture and everything you can think of. But, you know, peer-to-peer or country-to-country, the closest thing was the 1980 to 1988 war with Iraq, where Iraq fired missiles into Iranian cities, the so-called War of the Cities. But other than that, most of the wars Iran has been involved in, most of the conflicts Iran has been involved in the years of the revolution, have been things it has done to others.
Mm-hmm.
The regime doing it to its own civilian population, the regime doing it to, say, Kurdish rebel groups or Baluchi rebel groups, all of that kind of stuff. This is unprecedented because this is being done to the regime with, by basically very highly sophisticated and well-planned out military forces of the United States and Israel, and possibly within days even of Arab governments that may intervene as well.
What we're seeing right now can only be thought of as a stacked crisis. Like you said, some of it was done to them, but really the vast majority of it are disasters of their own making. And to that end, I also want to speak to our listeners. My parents live in Dubai. My father works there. So my parents live in Dubai. And the bombs have been detonating, the missiles and bombs have been detonating very close to where they live. And so this is a result of Iranian retaliation. Please pray for my parents. But I want to invite you to speak to that, that they're not going down without a fight, but they're also showing that civilian life really doesn't matter in their worldview.
That's absolutely right. They began, obviously, by talking about targeting Israel and about attacking U.S. bases, and they've done both. But the, again, unprecedented thing that they've done is they've attacked 8 to 10 countries so far in the region. As far as Cyprus, as far south as Oman, a country that is friendly to Iran. But the overwhelming brunt of the attack, over 1,000, imagine this, over 1,000 missiles and drones fired at the United Arab Emirates, and that especially at Dubai and Abu Dhabi, and overwhelmingly at non-military targets, at hotels, at civilian airports, at industrial ports, and energy and oil facilities as well. This seems to have heavily backfired in the sense that it seems like the Emiratis are united more than ever before. And the Gulf Arabs are coordinating with each other greatly. What's past is past. Bygones be bygones in terms of their rivalries between each other.
The other issue with the rivalries, too, is that there's a network of linked partners and aligned militias that Iran has fostered over the decades. And because of that, Tehran now has a lot of capacity for escalation regionally.
Well, it does and it doesn't. Mm. It had a lot more on October 7th, 2023, when Hamas invaded Israel. And all of the networks that Iran had in the region, the proxy network, which is what you're referring to, were intact. They still exist, but of course they've taken a tremendous beating in this war that they all fought between them and Israel from 2023 to 2025. So they're actually, yes, they're firing missiles from Iraq, these Iraqi militias into the Gulf. You know, Hezbollah is firing missiles towards Israel and fired some towards Cyprus. There's some of that going on. But compared to the network that existed in 2023, it's far weaker. They're doing damage. They're killing people here and there. But that network really suffered under the brunt of the war that they launched against Israel and Israel's very, very strong response.
Please present to us some clarification, because you have what I'm perceiving to be a lack of communication and confirmation here. Do we have verification that Ayatollah Ali Khamenei was actually killed in the initial assault window?
Oh, there's no doubt about that. I mean, okay. The regime itself has said that, and there's a photograph of his grave, and mm-hmm. Of his coffin with the mourning regime officials. There's no doubt about that. He died with a lot of his senior military officials in a remarkable feat of intelligence that they the Western, the Americans and the Israelis knew where he was, and they knew who he was meeting with, and they had an opportunity and they took it.
One of the narratives floating around the public sphere has to do with nuclear escalation and uncertainty. Do we have any wisdom or insight on that?
Not at all. I mean, mm-hmm. what's happening is Iran has been, you know, weakened because it's been at war in the last few years. It feverishly sought after last summer when there was this conflict between Israel and Iran and the United States over the nuclear issue. It's feverishly sought to reconstitute its nuclear capability. Mm-hmm. But this war is more about the other part of its triad. You mentioned one of them already, its proxy forces. The other one is its nuclear attempt to get nuclear weapons. The third one is its missile drone capacity. So this war has been all about its missile drone capacity, principally in terms of actual implementation.
In the light of all of this, then, one of the things we do have to think about is it's not like the domestic situation is solved now. If anything, it just plunges into a different kind of legitimacy and uncertainty.
Well, I would say that, you know, the war is when it's, what, third day, fourth mm-hmm. day? Iran is going to be a very different place going forward. Even if the war ended tomorrow morning, the fact that Khamenei is gone, the fact that so many of his senior leadership is gone, the damage that has been inflicted on the regime, even if it all ended, you know, right now, be very, very different place.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, Alberto. I'm really glad to have connected with you.
Thank you.
My guest has been Ambassador Alberto Fernandez, Vice President of the Middle East Media Research Institute, and we've been talking about the situation in Iran, trying to get some clarity about what's actually going on the ground. And like he said, regardless of whatever happens, Iran is going to be a very different place. Let's hope and pray it is for the better. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria, Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at avemaria.com. That's avemaria.com.
Hello, friends. Deacon Harold Burke-Sivers here. And I haven't been this excited about an up-and-coming speaker for a long time, Dr. Marcus Peter. Dr. Peter has the gift of combining deep theological insight, wisdom, and knowledge with personal testimony and story in a way that makes the power of the church's teaching and God's love felt deeply in the heart of all who hear him. If you are looking for someone for your next conference, parish mission, or event, look no further than Dr. Marcus Peter.
Visit MarcusBPeter.com to book Dr. Marcus Peter to speak at your event. At the Ave Maria website, you can continue the discussion and education through the Ave Maria Radio's links to social media. Ave Maria Radio has accounts on Facebook, X, TikTok, YouTube, and Instagram. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and find the social media symbols at the top of your screen. Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu. The Heart of the Interior Life with Elizabeth Jangle.
In the seventh rule of St. Ignatius of Loyola's 14 Rules for the Discernment of Spirits, St. Ignatius writes, "Let one who is in desolation consider how the Lord has left him in trial." In the seventh rule, St. Ignatius is inviting those who are experiencing spiritual desolation to consider, to think of spiritual desolation as a trial. Father Timothy Gallagher writes, "Persons in spiritual desolation should consider that such desolation is a trial permitted by the Lord. They should consider the nature of the trial And finally, they should consider the divine purpose in allowing the trial to occur. If we consider, why is God permitting me to experience this trial? When we recognize our spiritual desolation as a trial permitted by a loving God, and that there is a silver lining to it, then we will respond with greater courage to fight off the desolation.
For more information, visit AveMariaRadio.net.
Christ is the answer, with Father John Ricardo.
John 14. This is Jesus in the upper room with the disciples before he's going out to his sacrifice of himself for our salvation. And Philip says to the Lord, "Show us the Father, and we'll be satisfied." Jesus looks at Philip and says, "Philip, have I been with you all this time? Don't you understand? When you see me, you're looking at the Father." In fact, only two people throughout human history have given rise to the question, not who is he, but what is he? The two people are Buddha and Jesus. Buddha's answer was, don't come to me, don't look to me, look to my doctrine, look to what I teach. Jesus' answer was, come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble of heart. Jesus is explicitly claiming to be God.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. The cultural historian Christopher Dawson, he has been dubbed one of the foremost Catholic thinkers of modern times, especially as it pertains to engaging the faith at the heart of the culture. He retired from Harvard in 1962. John the 23rd sent him an apostolic blessing, and Dawson once observed that the first step in the transformation of culture is a change in the pattern of culture within the mind. Joseph Stewart joins us to talk more about Dawson and cultural transformation. Joseph Stewart is program chair of history and a fellow of Catholic studies at the University of Mary. He's also the author of this wondrous work, Christopher Dawson, A Cultural Mind in the Age of the Great War. Joseph, it's so great to speak with you. How are you?
I am doing well. Thank you, sir, for having me on today.
I have to tell you, you and I are kindred spirits. My predecessor had a deep appreciation for Dawson, and so he introduced me to him. And when I found out about your work and I had read the review of it, I realized that you are someone who shares a similar concern for making sure that the faith, which is the soundest, most objective measure of the truth, is spoken into the heart of the culture. So I want to ask you to open with, why is it more important now than ever to reclaim the thought and the work of people like Christopher Dawson?
Yeah, thank you for that question. So I want to just try to answer by quoting briefly from John Paul, Pope John Paul, who said this. He said, a quote, "A faith that does not become culture is not fully accepted, not entirely thought out, not faithfully lived,"
yeah,
unquote. And that's one of the famous quotations from him about the importance of culture and living out one's faith in the world. And I think that sometimes when the wider secular culture seems to be very oppressive and threatening, we want to retreat into ourselves and kind of think of the faith as just as kind of a private thing for my family or my club, rather than a communal social reality that is meant to go out into all the nations and all the world around us.
Right.
And I think that the recovery of Christopher Dawson and his work is a powerful reminder of this reality, that the faith must become culture.
You know, Joseph, I couldn't agree more. And frankly, one of the things that I do is I try to track back in history as to when we started losing sight of stuff like that. And sure, we can track it back to especially the Reformation, but especially in modernity, we have completely misconstrued the faith we profess as an entirely privatized enterprise. And it's never been historically that way. The history of anthropology shows the faith of a society completely defines the direction of its culture.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's right. And that, what Dawson is doing is really interesting is, you know, in the early 20th century, many Catholic thinkers were engaging with theology or mm-hmm. with philosophy or the arts or literature, you know, people like Chesterton and others.
Yeah.
But very few of them were engaging the modern mind at where it was heading, which was in the fields of history, the social sciences, and
right.
sociology. And Dawson was one of the first and one of the greatest Catholics to engage with those kind of modern fields, which were showing the very truth that you just mentioned, right? Which is that when we look at the history of world cultures and how they developed, develop, religion has always played a central role in that reality.
Right. And so it's a complete misrepresentation of human history to pretend that now we can be quote-unquote liberated from religion and therefore build a true human culture. If anything, the new atheism has shown us how it as an enterprise is its own failure.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And Dawson's, I think his greatest book, 1929, mm-hmm. Was called Progress and Religion. And it's an amazing book. I'm teaching it right now with my students here at the University of Mary. And it's a great book about how, yeah, religion is part of how the way that civilization first arose in the earliest temples and city-states of Mesopotamia. And, you know, archaeology is confirming, you know, to this day, these insights of Dawson's. So it's part of the development of human culture and human civilization is religion. And also, the flip side is the relationship to nature and the material world. And that's the wonderful thing about Dawson and the idea of culture is that it's a concept that bridges between spirituality and religion on the one hand and the human person as a creature, as a physical creature who lives within the context of nature on the other hand, right? So it's kind of an incarnational kind of idea. It's both spiritual and material, and a cultural development has to happen in terms of both of those sides.
And therein lies the issue, because if I may quote Dawson, as you've been doing, he made very clear, a society that has lost its religion has already lost its culture, which means that in order for us to understand what culture really is, we have to reclaim the source of that culture. Literally, what man worships shapes the way the society lives.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's really exciting when you take that idea and you say, okay, we can see how that's true in the medieval period. We can see how that's true in, you know, maybe ancient Egypt or something, which was a culture that was totally devoted to religion. But then you ask the question, how does that apply to today, right, in modern secular cultures, right? And this is the whole sort of flip side of Dawson's work is showing, well, what it looks like, right, is that you create a spiritual vacuum inside our own contemporary modern secular cultures, which then sort of sucks into it or draws into it whatever kind of is happening in the spiritual environment, you know, around it. And that's often a secular religion,
right?
Like Nazism in the 20th century or communism and things. In America, it's things like, you know, sports and the idea of progress and yep. money and all these kinds of things that kind of become the guiding vision for a society.
Yep, and that's a problem. The guiding vision of a society will make or break its development in actual culture. And I've been doing commentaries on the devolution of our art. Because art becomes one of those visual representations that shows either the continued development and progress of culture or its actual inevitable corruption. And so look at the modern art that we have in comparison with what we've had in human history. The fact that we had an artist with the audacity to put a crucifix in urine shows us that we have embraced depravity and called it a commentary on society.
Yeah, that's right. No, there's many elements of modern culture which are showing a kind of decline, you know, and Dawson talked about this. He said, you know, cultures can decline. We know that in history, the Roman, ancient Roman culture, you know, eventually came to an end. There's been other societies that have failed for sometimes environmental reasons, but often it's because their vision failed. It failed to be passed on, and you know, the break between the generations happened, and art becomes decadent or even ceases to exist, and so decline is a very real part of human history.
Yeah, and like Dawson mentioned, and like you just brought up, when we start seeing the decline of culture, we can actually track it back to where it first began, which was a social disinterest in religion. It happens at this juncture, this point in society where the collective populace suddenly decides that the faith has nothing to contribute to the way the society ought to live. And again, you know, so morality is out of the question, epistemology is out of the question, logic is out of the question. The moment you cast, especially the Christian faith, out of the public sphere.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, in the European world, a key moment there was the French Revolution,
mm-hmm.
Beginning in 1789, which definitely tried to expel the Christian faith from, you know, the public culture. And in our part of the world, the more the English-speaking world, I think it's maybe a little later. It's more and a slower, too, process of kind of conducted through industry and kind of the monetization of culture and privatization of culture that has slowly kind of eroded much of the public witness. So I think that's a two-part process there, political in Europe and economic in our part of the world. But I think that's what we could say.
Yep, I couldn't agree more. So, and you're singing my song, bringing up the French Revolution. You and I are going to be here for the next hour at this point. You've got people like Robespierre, but you also had, and so the political movement spearheaded, you know, people like Marat, Roland, but they're spearheaded by thinkers who drove that. I mean, you think about Diderot, or worse, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and the complete divorce of reality from objective truth, as if the person interiorly ought to exist as an ethereal separate notion from reality as is, which was a completely novel version of an epistemology that has resulted in the ruin of us understanding the human person.
Yeah, that's right. And that's one of the wonderful things about Dawson is that he's a realist. You know, he believes, he knows that we can know things, we can know truth. And so his work is really complementary to philosophy's Thomas Aquinas. You know, in a way, Dawson is the history of what Aquinas is to philosophy, in a way. Because he's a realist, he's a philosophical realist. We can know the truth about the past, we can understand it, we can look into it, we can see the facts. And so I think that's part of his greatness, too.
Yep. My guest is Joseph Stewart. He's joining us to talk more about Christopher Dawson and the question of cultural transformation. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
The following program is brought to you in part by MyCatholicWill.com. Surveys show that more than half of Americans do not have a will. At MyCatholicWill.com, it takes as little as 15 minutes to write your will and secure a legacy of faith. MyCatholicWill.com is the exclusive online destination for creating a Catholic will. The process of writing a will is simple and now more accessible than ever. MyCatholicWill.com, a legacy of faith for those you love.
This program brought to you in part by the following nonprofit research and educational institute.
This Lent, join Catholics across the country starting on Ash Wednesday, February 18th, for Bible Across America, a nationwide study on the practical relevance of the Bible for our daily lives as we prepare to celebrate the resurrection of our Lord on Easter Sunday. Spearheaded by our sponsor, the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology, with some of today's leading Catholic voices. To learn more, visit stpaulcenter.com/ave.
Feeling worn out, overwhelmed, or just plain tired of feeling tired as a parent? Well, you're not alone. Parenting can drain even the most faithful moms and dads, especially at this time of year.
Join us, Dr. Craig and Lisa Popcheck, for a free Ave Maria Radio webinar, Reclaiming the Joy of Parenting, Overcoming Burnout, on Wednesday, March 18th at 7:30 p.m. Eastern.
Get practical, faith-filled tools to recharge your batteries and rediscover the joy of raising Catholic kids. Register now at AveMariaRadio.net.
How do the three theological virtues, faith, hope, and charity, fit into our prayer? The Catholic Catechism says we enter into prayer as we enter into liturgy through the narrow gate of faith. We seek and desire the face of the Lord. It is His word we wish to hear and keep. The Holy Spirit instructs us to celebrate the liturgy in expectation of Jesus' return and teaches us to pray in hope. Hope is nourished in us by the prayer of the Church and personal prayer. The Psalms, especially through their concrete and varied language, teach us to fix our hope in God. Love is poured into our hearts by the Holy Spirit. Prayer formed by the liturgical life draws everything into Christ's love for us, which enables us to respond to Him by loving as He loved us. Love is the source of prayer. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism. May the good Lord bless you.
Strained or broken relationships are a given in most of our lives. Friends fall away, siblings drift apart, children sever ties with their parents, and despite our best efforts, these painful fissures are difficult to mend. Hi, I'm Dr. Ray. If you want to learn how to communicate better with the difficult people in your life and be a more easygoing, more forgiving person, check out my book, How to Get Along with Almost Everybody. Check it out. And all my other books on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. I'm speaking with Joseph Stewart about the Catholic historian and commentator Christopher Dawson, a cultural mind in the age of the Great War. Now, Joseph, you and I were talking about how, in a lot of senses, Dawson was a kind of prophet ahead of his time because he saw how reading the ebbs and flows of the social sciences showed us where mankind was inevitably going. And, okay, so this, to quote him, the whole tendency of modern life is towards scientific planning, organization, central control, standardization, and specialization. And what he's really trying to highlight here is, as we move further and further away from God, we move further and further away from the meaning of the human person. And so this mechanization and overt efficiency-driven version of humanity tends to take over. And that's what we're seeing in the public sphere now. We are measured by productivity over and above true human flourishing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, no, prophetic, I think, is a good way to put it. He, you know, he was British. He grew up in rural Yorkshire in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, in a time when there was horse-drawn carriages. And then, you know, he lived into 1970. So he lived beyond the dropping of the atomic bomb into the age of technology and science. And
right.
Just an incredible range of change. And then, to cap it off, he came to teach at Harvard University at the end of his life. His last position was as chair, a professor of Catholic studies at Harvard University, and he could see that how modern culture was developing. He appreciated America in many ways, especially our tradition of free liberal arts, you know, schools that are independent of the state. He thought that was amazing about America, but he definitely saw, those tendencies in our culture.
And one of the things that he winds up pointing out is that if we are not careful, education itself, just quoting him again, education itself becomes an essential part of the machine. The mind has to be completely measured and controlled by techniques of the scientific expert as the task which it is being trained to perform. So he cautioned us that if we don't catch ourselves, we're going to become an empiricist, materialist society, and therefore lose the capacity as a society to observe the transcendent and therefore contemplate the divine.
Yeah, you know, his comments, well, not comments, his books, his writings on education are very profound, because you're right, he points to our modern public education as a serious part of the problem. Here's a brief quotation from here. He says, "The central problem of the Catholic educationalist is a sociological one,
right.
How to make students culturally conscious of their religion. Otherwise, they will be divided personalities with a Christian faith and a pagan culture which contradict one another." That's it. That's where we are. And so that's the analysis of our situation. The solution, then, he began to write in his great book, The Crisis of Western Education, is to integrate those two things, right, and begin to understand through history how religion and culture have always integrated with each other, and that can inspire us anew then in the modern world.
Yep. And I want to expand the conversation a little into the big picture question. As a historian, this is a man who made himself a student of the documents of the text of the ebbs and flows of human occurrences, wars, events. But he viewed all of this through the lens of the faith that he had come to espouse as his own, the Catholic faith. And then he comes to the startling conclusion that he shares with all of us, that the Christian view of history is the only one which gives spiritual meaning to the whole course of human progress. We are often taught, especially in modernity right now, to see history as this constant struggle, this Hegelian Marxist view of conflict, you know, the oppressor and the one being oppressed and overcoming that. And yet, really, it's the Christian narrative that gives meaning at all to the entirety of the flow of history.
Yeah, that's right. He wrote several essays that are just beautiful on this very, very theme, that the Judeo-Christian tradition is unlike any other world religion in the sense that it conceives of time not as meaningless and not as eternal cycles, as circles, but as having a beginning. God created the heaven and the earth, having a middle, when the Messiah, when Jesus came, mm-hmm. and then having an end, right? So in other words, it has a direction, which is the basis for a true sense of progress,
right.
That can underlie human development. And that's totally unique in the Christian tradition.
Right. Which presents us a real problem when we're looking at our modern culture as it is, just in this particular milieu. We're suffering a complete loss of the spiritual sense of what has brought us this human flourishing in our civilization as we know it. And so it would be in some sense a futile effort to pretend that we can regain a sense of a societal sentiment of human flourishing if we don't regain as well the spirituality that drove it here from the get-go.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, his phrase was theological optimism.
Right.
If we lose that theological optimism, that time has a direction and a meaning, then we have to work, we try to work really hard to replace it with something else, right? And so our lives, we get up in the morning, and if we don't have that theological optimism, then we have to make something up. We got to create something. We're going to work really hard. We're going to make a lot of money. We're going to have a lot of honor. We're going to have a lot of pleasure. Whatever it is as a society, we replace that theological optimism with becomes our operating religion. But the problem is that that's a form of idolatry, and history also shows, you know, what direction that these sort of pagan gods in history have gone is usually toward the destruction of the society and lots of blood sacrifices.
Yep, that is actually true. I wrote my dissertation on that, and it's inevitable. We devolve into that if we don't recapture the Christian narrative. There's a bit of a Girardian premise here. If we remove Christ as the quote-unquote ultimate scapegoat, then we run the risk of bringing back some kind of bloodshed in the process. But really what I want to drive home here is, Dawson was very clear, Christianity is factually the core dynamic element that drove Western civilization, which means we can't even begin to have a conversation on Western civilization if we don't acknowledge that its roots are Christendom.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and so what's fascinating about Dawson's historical work is that he directed his readers' attention to the area of history most forgotten, mm-hmm. which was the so-called Dark Age.
Right.
Right, when basically from 500, the time of St. Benedict, until maybe around 1,000 with the conversion of the Vikings, that 500 years is when the Benedictine monks and missionaries were spreading out across Europe, bringing the faith to the tribal chiefs across the forests of Germany, building monasteries, and that ultimately laid the basis for a united, spiritually united continent that we call Europe, which is the bedrock of Western civilization, where our own culture in modern America comes from. And so he's pointing us to saying, look, guys, this is actually even more interesting than the time of Dante and Thomas Aquinas. That's really great and really fascinating. But what's almost more important, in a sense, is to see how that came about.
Right.
And that was in those early medieval time.
Right. And that's why the lie of the Dark Ages, you know, these backwater peasants who didn't know any better until the enlightenment of the scientific empiricist revolution came about. This narrative of history, it's baffling to think that this is the standardized narrative that we buy today, when in reality, those quote-unquote backwater peasants had a wider, a more expansive view of creation and reality, realizing that the material order was, in a sense, sacramental, lowercase s, pointing to the higher divine order.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's right. And that's another wonderful thing about Dawson's work is that he's not an elitist. In mm-hmm. other words, he wants to understand people on their own terms and not dismiss them. And he wants to go into the past and he wants to see, okay, so what was the mentality? What is the profound insights of what we could say, primitive cultures? Well, maybe not so primitive. Maybe actually quite sophisticated in their view of reality as incarnational, like you said, as sacramental,
right.
as a mixture of material and spiritual reality. And he holds that up. He holds that up as an example to us moderns who think of ourselves as very sophisticated, but actually have lost a very sort of nuanced, bi-level kind of view of reality that so many people in history have had.
Right, and that's exactly why he cautions us that if we attempt to appeal some kind of religious sentiment, he called it religious emotion, especially as it pertains to ebbs and flows of government and culture, if we divorce that from religious belief, we run the risk of becoming the authors of our own ruin.
Yeah, that's right, because we become revolutionary.
Right.
So he said that what happens when you lose religion is you become revolutionary, because you have to have a reason to live, and if it's not this theological optimism of Christianity, then it's going to be some kind of modern ideology which promises a worldly salvation. Well, to achieve worldly salvation, you have to harness all the reins and power of government and overthrow the existing evil society that we are, right, and overthrow it completely to rebuild, you know, the new, you know, future happiness. And that has never worked, and regularly in history leads to incredible amounts of destruction.
Yep. It's babies that are thrown out with the bathwater, and inevitably all you wind up doing is causing a massacre. And again, you know, Dawson was prophetic. He saw that this was what was happening. In fact, exactly what you just mentioned, he would call it appealing to a kind of moral and spiritual sentiment within the loyalty of the members. But here's the problem. If we don't find common truths, and I mean objective truth, that binds us, a recognition of principles and ideals that are transcendental, then those very members will wind up turning against us.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So the Dawson is looking at individual cultures, their ways of life, to appreciate them, you know, sort of their way of, you know, believing and doing. But you're right. He also connected individual cultures to what our humanity, our universal humanity, what we could call it natural law. He didn't use that phrase a lot, but that's what he means. This idea that, yeah, there's something transcendent above the different human cultures and even ages in time, which allows different peoples to exchange ideas with each other and really grow in truth, and which is the essential definition of progress. And so that, yeah, that kind of local knowledge, particulars of history go along with a kind of universal vision of what it means to be human.
Yep. And the universal vision ultimately grounds itself in the recognition of the divine. In other words, for Dawson, man only truly finds his real meaning when he's connected to God. And therefore, culture only finds its true meaning when it's connected to God.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
So we're running out of time in this segment, but Joseph, I really enjoyed this conversation. Why should our listeners pick up Christopher Dawson and read, and what would be a good starting point?
Sure. Boy, you know, Dawson's work has so much to say to us today. It's becoming more relevant, right? It's being all republished right now by the Catholic University of America Press, all 23 of his books on progress, on European unity, on the making of Europe, and education, all politics, all kinds of things. So I would urge everyone to check out the Dawson page at the Catholic University of America Press and then see what's coming out soon.
Thank you so much, Joseph. My guest, Joseph Stewart, Program Chair of History, a fellow of Catholic Studies at the University of Mary. We've been talking about the heritage and legacy of Christopher Dawson, this great commentator. I'm Marcus Peter.